Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist. Are we just going to get right into it, or should we make some small talk? We've been talking for hours. Oh. We've been catching up.
Well, you know, we have talked about. So I don't know. Here's some random shit to shoot. Stanley Tucci made a Negroni on I guess on Instagram, and people posted the video everywhere to be like, oh, masterclass in how to make a Negroni. And look. Here's the thing. Stanley Tucci, very classy guy. And he says, like, I guess in his extended video that it's not how it's supposed to be made, but he's making it his way. Mm-hmm. But he proceeds to, like, the measurements are all off. It's not 1-1-1. And he shakes it. He shakes his Negroni.
Oh, no.
And then and he puts it up. He serves it up. And then he garnishes it with orange juice. Like orange wedge, and he squeezed the juice in there.
No.
So basically, it's everything you could do wrong with a Negroni. Has a few defining factors.
It's like anti-Negroni.
It is. It's like you took every step and you acknowledged how it should be done and went, ha ha, fuck you, step, and did it differently. So that was my morning. As I woke up and I saw the video because somebody tagged me and it was like, oh, look at this. This is like a masterclass in Negroni bartending. And I was like, okay. Because, you know, I feel like every now and then, like, a celebrity will step up and be, like, a master bartender on some sort of social media. And sometimes they're fine, but usually they're just making a mockery of the thing that the rest of us actually, you know, devote time and energy to. But, yeah, and not to crap on him. He says it's the way he likes it, and that's fine. However you like your drink is
right.
Fine.
You can make a drink however you like it. Just don't call it a Negroni, maybe.
It stops being... It's a... like, you got a great name. Call it a Stanley Tucci. Like, that's great. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's fine.
Do you think sometimes I theorize about these things because it is Twitter. If you were a celebrity and you wanted to just get, like, buzz around a thing, would you name it a thing just to, like... get people to talk about it and like get, because I feel like when it's only positive response, it doesn't get a lot of response. But when there's a possibility for negative response, when things are controversial, people are a lot louder about it. So maybe he did it on purpose so that people would talk about it and he'd have bartenders being like, that's not a fucking Negroni. It's a theory. It's just a theory I'm working on.
I think if that was the idea, in regular times, it'd be like, all right, I wouldn't do that, but I get it.
But in these times, we're
this particular moment where there are hundreds of thousands of highly trained, highly skilled bartenders out of work while we watch somebody that has millions of dollars incorrectly make our drink at home, and if the thought of them doing that for clicks and likes and controversy, I don't think he's doing that for that reason. I think he says it in the IG, like, this is the way I like it. Like I said, I think that's fine. I'm not no shade to him. I think he did it. He made a drink the way he liked it, and that's fine. But the idea of somebody making it wrong just to, like, I want to get controversy. It's like, from us, all of us, our like league of out of work bartenders, you want to get us involved because we've got nothing else to do right now. So okay,
but be outraged.
You could pay me a small, like, dusting of your income to come to your house and make you a proper Negroni, and it would probably feed me and mine for years to come. So I really don't want you to see you make an improper Negroni in these times. That's all I'm saying. But no hate towards the man.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that he meant it in malice like that. I'm just that I was just calling out a what if scenario. It was a little bit of a conspiracy theory. I'm not trying to throw Stanley Tucci under the bus. We're not, that's not what we do here. We don't throw Stanley Tucci under the bus. That's not our thing. That's not our logo. Our motto is something with a twist. Yes, history.
Well, look, and innovation is important, and making what you can on the fly is important. All these things are important in the history of bartending. And if you've heard me talk at all on this, you know that one of the ideals that I espouse is that I don't really like people gatekeeping bartending. I think that however you want to do it is fine. The only part that bothered me was when people were like, oh, this is a masterclass. Like, this is how you do it. It's like, well, it's not. It's fine if that's how he likes it, and I respect that. He can drink his drink every once in a while, using great technique, like the way he's making it, the way he's shaking it, the way, whatever, it's fine. It's more like, I just don't want anybody to think like, I was going to say when maybe this quarantine ends and maybe I have a job again, who knows, but if I can have a job again, hopefully someday, if suddenly everybody's ordering shaken Negronis, I was gonna say, man, that's gonna grind my gears, but actually, if I could have a job again, I'd make 1,000 shaken Negronis. I don't care.
I think the word masterclass is a buzzword on the internet. I think that's a thing. I don't know. Yeah. I have many conspiracy theories about the internet. I think.
Oh, I'd love to make that a side podcast.
Oh yeah,
this is conspiracy theories.
I mean, it's all like algorithm. I think mostly I have theories because I don't really understand it, but I know you know, you hashtag certain things and like certain things are buzzwords. It's kind of like how on Facebook when you say congratulations in a post, then it gets more views. Yeah. I don't know. Actually, because Stanley Tucci is a famous person, probably he wasn't thinking about any of this in this way.
No, I think
he's,
I
mean, probably just like, I'm gonna make a video, here's a Negroni, but it's not a Negroni, but this is how I like Negronis.
Yeah,
because I'm Stanley Tucci.
It's totally fine. He's a very, very attractive man. He's a very talented actor. He's got very nice arms. Very,
well,
like,
that changes everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, there's a lot going from this video. I just, you know,
he see that I have another theory.
He's got arms.
Yes. That's why he's shaking the Negronis. He's got to show off his arms. Got to shake his moneymakers.
Well, you know, that's like, I get it. Like, we all, I don't know. Actually, it depends. Like, if you're like me and you've got like, you know, like, I have muscle, but there's also, I'm old and I'm not a professional celebrity. So there's some flab on these arms. They do a little shaky shake of their own when I shake. I'm still going to shake a drink when it's supposed to be shaken and stir when it's supposed to be stirred. But that's fine. Now, like I said, no hate to Stanley Tucci. I just thought it was funny. I was tagged in this thing. I was like, oh, come on, guys. It's made really wrong. And I hate to be the person to say, like, well, actually, on the internet. So I'm just going to say, if that's the way you like it, that's cool. But it's also wrong.
Right. You're not going to say anything on the internet. You're just going to say something on a podcast on the internet. It's fine.
Oh, I know. I said something on the internet. Nope.
Oh, you did?
I did. We're going to cut most of this out. Okay. It's been way too much Stanley Tucci.
I don't know how much Stanley Tucci content do. Let's see if we can get a little bit more out of Stanley Tucci. It's 7 o'clock. That's what's going on. We're recording and it's 7 o'clock. And that was everybody making noise and cheering for the essential workers. So woohoo!
Woo! Yeah.
This episode is about someone near and dear to our podcast. And we've made you wait a long time to hear about him.
Yes.
Who are we talking about today?
Well, we're talking about one of the most famous seminal American authors, but more importantly, at least specifically to this podcast, one of America's most famous drinkers. That's Ernest Hemingway.
Ernie!
Yes. We joke about Ernest Hemingway popping up in every alcohol story. And to be honest, he gets a lot of attributions. He shows up in... He was alive and active during the most formidable time period of cocktail culture in America. We're dealing with, like, cocktail culture, hitting prohibition, hitting war, like...
And that was, like, his coming of age. Like, he was born in... born in 1899? So when prohibition started, he was like, I'm 20 years old.
I think this he was 21. Yes. 21. When Prohibition started. Yeah. So if you don't know who Ernest Hemingway is, I will give you a very brief biography. We're not going to do a book report on this podcast. All right. So Ernest Hemingway, obviously famous author. He was born July 21st, 1809. He was born in Oak Park, Illinois. After high school, he worked as a reporter for the Kansas City Star. After that, he enlisted as an ambulance driver in World War I. He was stationed on the Italian front. He had a very serious injury that sent him back home. He moved back home. He got married to the first of four wives. He's got a very complicated history with marriage. But he moved, after that he moved to Paris. This was like around the time of Prohibition. He moved to Paris. He fell in with a whole gaggle of famous modernist writers and artists. He was part of the Lost Generation expat community. During World War II, he took his journalism to the front lines. He transcribed the liberation of Paris and the Normandy landing. He relocated to Key West in the 30s and then Cuba in the 40s and 50s. And he traveled regularly throughout. In the 60s, he bought a house in Idaho, where sadly he ended his life. All along the way, he was drinking around the world. He was experiencing a bevy of cultures, and he was transcribing and writing his experiences all along the way.
His life was colored by many experiences and travels, and he drank pretty much everywhere he went. Hemingway is famously quoted as saying, "Don't bother with churches, government buildings, or city squares. If you want to know about a culture, spend a night in its bars." So, you know.
Well, and that's one of the things. You can't really separate Ernest Hemingway from his, I would say, I mean, he loved drinking. Let's be honest. He loved drinking. He wrote about it. He talked about it. He was a fan of drinking. There's an entire book written about this that came up. I actually have not read this book. I've read many Hemingway books. I've not read this book that's about Hemingway called To Have and Have Another by Philip Green.
Which is a play out. On, it's a play on another, and a Hemingway book, To Have and Have Not.
Yes. So this book is about where Hemingway drank, what he drank, how he drank. His drinking is I don't want to say it definitely doesn't overshadow his writing, but it's an integral part to his life, to his history. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can't really separate the two. And because of that, because of how prolific he was, what an important figure he was during this time period, there are so many cocktails and stories and thoughts associated with him. So we're going to kind of go through some of those. We're going to talk about what is fantasy, what is fiction, what is real, what is sort of embellished. What did Hemingway like to drink? What did he not drink? And what drinks did he make? Let's get into it.
Yeah. So where should we start on this lush map of Hemingway alcoholic beverage indulgence?
I mean, obviously, the first drink you're going to jump to when you talk about Hemingway is the Hemingway Daiquiri.
Ah.
There's that. There are actually two drinks that have his name, the Hemingway Daiquiri and the Papa Doble. Both of these drinks, they are contributed to things that Hemingway sort of invented via requests to his bartenders while he was in Cuba. But actually, they're probably the same drink, is what I think the modern consensus is. When I was first bartending, I learned them as two separate drinks. And by that, I mean, we've talked about this before, but the Hemingway Daiquiri, the idea behind it is you take a traditional daiquiri, which is 2 ounces rum, 3/4 to 1 ounce lime, 3/4 ounce simple syrup. And because Hemingway had diabetes in his family, he didn't want to have any sugar. So he subbed out the sugar element, the simple syrup, for grapefruit juice and maraschino liqueur. That's the understanding behind the Hemingway Daiquiri, and that's how we make it today. If you order a Hemingway Daiquiri in most bars, you'll get a drink that's a regular size cocktail that just happens to be a daiquiri minus the sweet plus maraschino and grapefruit. But the Papa Doble, which is shorthand for I want a daiquiri but make it double.
Yeah. Which is an interesting story. That's like the origin story, right? This is the story that I've heard about the Hemingway Daiquiri that was at the El Floridita, where he like he went in to like use the bathroom and he saw all of the daiquiris lined up on the bar and he was like, can I try one of those? And the bartender who was like actually like at the time like that was he was known as the cocktail king, Constantino Ribalagua Vert, known to his friends as Constant, but he was like, yeah, sure, try a daiquiri. And he tried it and he was and Hemingway was like, I'd like it, it's good, but I prefer it with twice the rum and without the sugar. And that's how that was made. That's like kind of the lore around that, so much so that at that bar in Havana to this day there is a bronze statue of Hemingway,
right?
And like it's like Hemingway leaning on the bar and they put a fresh daiquiri in front of it every day.
Well, and that's become like associated with, you know, you'll see like the Papa Doble or the Hemingway daiquiri. Sometimes it's like double the rum plus grapefruit plus maraschino liqueur. Like that, they kind of get co-opted together because probably this all goes back to the man, and probably what he was drinking was he didn't want to have sugar and he did want a higher proof drink. So probably he was drinking both at the same time. Probably he was having a double daiquiri, which is just that, like you said, like a daiquiri with twice as much alcohol, half as much sugar. And he was probably also having it with a little grapefruit juice and a little maraschino liqueur to add a little bit of sweetness. So,
yeah. You know. Even though it was like, it's still sugar, though.
It is. I mean, obviously at the time we didn't have the full understanding of what that meant, how to avoid sugar. In his mind, well, he was replacing it with a maraschino liqueur, which is dry, which is not sweet, and grapefruit juice, which is a juice, so that's healthy. So you kind of get why he thinks like, oh, that's a good standard, when really he's just adding probably more sugar, honestly.
Yeah, because like they both have a lot of sugar. It's used like a whole grapefruit. A whole grapefruit has 8 grams of sugar, like the same amount as like an orange, you know, like. And I actually looked this up because I was interested. The recommended daily sugar intake for a diabetic male is 36 grams. So, and by all accounts of how much Hemingway drank, he would definitely exceed that if he was, like, one of the stories is that he finished 17 of these daiquiris in a day. So you're definitely getting more than 36 grams of sugar. Yeah, but yeah, like you said, they didn't know. They didn't really understand.
Well, but that does lead to, because he did have that awareness. He at least, like, even if at the time we didn't quite understand how sugar could be incorporated in our systems, how it could be processed, so things like fructose, naturally occurring sugars, we didn't quite understand. This does lead to, while we're on the topic of rum, you know, daiquiris. Another rum cocktail that is often contributed to being his quote-unquote favorite is the mojito.
Is that true, though?
No. So, the El Floridita, which you talked about as being the place that he drank his daiquiris, that is accurate. Another bar in Havana was the La Bodeguita. So that is the bar that claims to be the place that Hemingway drank his mojitos and claims that the mojito was Hemingway's favorite cocktail. If you don't know what a mojito is, we talked about it a few times, but for a refresher, that is rum, lime, sugar, mint, and soda. Now, sugar, obviously a prominent ingredient in a mojito. I mean, most mojitos have up to an ounce, if not more, simple syrup. So they're very sweet drinks. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of people question if he would have been a fan of this drink or had the drink there. The other big thing, like we've touched on, is that he never wrote about drinking mojitos. And he wrote about everything he drank. Like, he never included it. Yeah, it was never a thing he talked about. Now, this myth, though, really propagated. Like, it became a destination point for drinkers to go to La Bodeguita and drink a mojito, because that's what Hemingway did.
Wait, why did they think that that's what Hemingway did, though?
So, La Bodeguita had a sign on the wall, had a piece of, like, I think it was butcher's paper, that had supposedly Hemingway's handwriting on it that said, the translation was, my daiquiri is at La Floridita, my mojito is at La Bodeguita. So, I drink my daiquiri at La Floridita. I drink my mojito here. So because of that, they gained the reputation as the place to get a mojito the way Hemingway liked it. It was that cultural connection. Like, if I drink a mojito here, I'm drinking like Hemingway. And it did amazingly well for the bar. The bar had an explosion of popularity because of this claim. It wasn't until many, many years later that one of Hemingway's former friends, who was a Cuban journalist by the name of Fernando Campo Amor, who basically came forward and said, it was in a book called Trading with the Enemy, but he admitted, like, look, I was like talking about how to promote my friend's bar that was La Bodeguita. We joked about making it a place that Hemingway drank. He was friends with Hemingway already. He had his writing samples. So they gave some of his writing samples to a graphic artist. The graphic artist made this little sign up that was supposedly in Hemingway's handwriting. They hung it up and the rest was history. So like I said, this journalist did come forward and say it was totally fake. Like, we made this up.
That's a very well thought out forgery plan. Like,
oh yeah.
That's intense. You hired a graphic designer.
You were at the height of wherever Hemingway drank. You wanted to drink. He was accredited for all the best bars in the land, all the best cocktails in the land. Like, why not say he drank mojitos at your bar? Like I said, probably, well, okay, I don't want to say not a drink he would drink.
I mean, but he would probably want to sub the sugar out. Like, how do you do that in a mojito?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, while there is documented proof that he did not drink mojitos and definitely did not drink mojitos famously at La Bodeguita, he did drink a drink that was very similar to a mojito on his book. What was the book? I think book and boat combined. While Hemingway did not drink the mojito specifically, he did definitely consume, documented that he consumed a drink very similar to the mojito. And that was aboard his boat, the Pilar. His skipper at the time, Gregorio Fuentes, I guess was also his bartender. And clearly he was a very skilled bartender, because a drink that he would make Hemingway when Hemingway was feeling under the weather was a combination of lemon juice, honey, mint, rum, and sparkling water. I will say, whether it was lime juice or lemon juice, it was originally written in Spanish, and so could be read as young lemon or lime, because it was just green lemon was the way it was translated directly. So it's arguable it was a lemon lime. But in either case, he was drinking basically a mojito, because that's everything that's in a mojito with the substitution of honey for the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, fun fact, Fuentes was also one of the inspirations for The Old Man and the Sea.
Oh, nice. Got a little call out in the book.
Yeah. So Hemingway definitely drank things that were adjacent to mojitos. He just didn't drink them famously.
All right. Cool.
But, you know, let's get away from rum. We know Hemingway drank a lot of rum, but I want to talk about some of the other spirits that he probably enjoyed. First up is one of my favorite spirits, and that's vermouth.
Ah!
Yes. This is actually one of my first... I have a lot of distinct book-based memories around the way that people talk about food in books. Like, it's no crazy fact that I ended up in food service, because those are the things that I always remembered the most from literature. I remember in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Turkish Delight. Yes. I assumed it was just the richest honey and nutty and gooey thing. When I read Little House on the Prairie, I wanted to eat nothing but dry ass biscuits smothered in natural honey. Like, I thought that just sounded like the best thing. And when I read The Sun Also Rises, I wanted to know what vermouth tastes like, because there's a passage where one of the injured soldier, who's the central character, he has people sneak vermouth into his hospital room. And this is actually a true to life from Hemingway. When he was injured in World War One, he would have people sneak Cinzano vermouth into his hospital room. But that was one of my first encounters with Hemingway, was The Sun Also Rises. That was the first encounter. And that was the first idea I had of vermouth. And I didn't know what it tasted like. I'd never had it before. I didn't know what that even meant. But I knew at that time that I loved the idea of just secreted bottles of vermouth.
Secreted bottles in particular. I love
yes,
the idea.
Absolutely, yes.
I love the idea of Hemingway in the hospital, like, I know I'm in the hospital, but I just want to party.
And with vermouth, too. It's not like, give me the hard stuff. I got it through this. No, no, no. I want to drink some fortified and aromatized wine. I love that. But yeah, Hemingway loved his vermouth. Obviously, I know it makes sense. He would have been exposed to it throughout his time in Italy and France. He maintained a love for it. One of his other drinks, it was like a call order on his boat, was the vermouth panache, which is a 3-to-1, 3 parts dry vermouth to 1 part sweet vermouth with a dash of Ango. Beautiful cocktail. I love the idea of that as like a boat drink, because boat drinks, we think it's like sweet, it's sugary. But this is something he drank when he was on the sea as a low alcohol cocktail. It's very contemplative. It's not going to get you wasted, but it's very nuanced. Sounds like a beautiful, beautiful cocktail to drink on the high seas.
I like that.
Yes.
I mean, it was like kind of storming in Brooklyn earlier. You should just like open your window and stand at it with the winds and the mist and with your vermouth cocktail.
Well, I was kind of like, look, this morning was really gross and rainy. And so I use it as justification for not leaving the house more than normal. I mean, I usually let myself get out and like do a walk or a run for 15, 20 minutes, something that I can kind of get out either early enough in the day that people aren't out or late enough in the evening that people are home. That was a good excuse. But now the weather is cleared up, but I'm almost mad at it. I'm like, I wish you had just rained all day so I could just stay inside and not feel bad about it. I'm not going to feel bad about it anyway.
But no, don't feel bad. And it's been like raining off and on. It's been like beautiful or it's like thunderstorms. It's weird, freaky, freaky weather right now. But anyway, I just got a little joy out of, I imagined you at your window with the winds.
Well, earlier today when I was finishing up my research, I was definitely drinking some vermouth on the rocks by a rainy window. Oh, I love you. You know me. Here's the thing. We'll get a bit more into this later, but I have a certain connection, a love for Hemingway that I don't think it's cool and I don't think it's fully like unproblematic because he's a very problematic figure when you get into some of his. But I do love his writing. I do love his. There's a lot about him that I connect with. And one thing is his palate, like the way that he drinks is very much the way that I drink.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the volume. Don't worry. I'm all right. No, but his love of like vermouth, his love of we're going to get into sherry. We got to go through the rest of this list.
Okay,
let's
keep trekking along. Let's go on.
Okay. The next spirit that Hemingway definitely had a love for, I'm going to use his own words here, was, if I have any money, I can't think of any better way of spending money than on champagne.
Champagne! You champagne. Love champagne!
I do. I love
you
champagne.
You have a Hemingway palate.
I have a Hemingway palate. I don't know what that means. It might be a bad thing.
He's got good taste. It's fine.
He does. And Hemingway's characters drink champagne. They drink champagne down to the specific brand of champagne. It was clearly something that the man invested himself in, such to the point that he is credited with a very popular champagne cocktail. The cocktail is the Death in the Afternoon, which is a mix of champagne and absinthe. Also, another ingredient that he loved. I'm going to not quote directly, but he basically said, like, absinthe curls around inside of you better than whiskey could. Like, he was a big fan of absinthe, and this is definitely a drink that lives up to its name, but it actually, the drink he offered to a cocktail book in 1935. It was a book about like famous authors contributing drinks, but it had already been the name of one of his books about bullfighting, Death in the Afternoon, from 1932. What came first? Like, there's a story that's like the drink came about after a high-risk rescue at sea that he'd been part of in the early 1930s, so that's where the drink name came from, then that's where the book title came from, and then that's where the cocktail title came from in the next book. It's hard to really trace it exactly, but
it's a little murky.
Yeah. In any case, I would say Hemingway invented the drink Death in the Afternoon, which is just champagne and absinthe. He's the one that's credited for that.
I can't believe that of all of the people who've ever existed in France, nobody thought of putting those two things together.
Well, okay. You're fair point. I'm sure somebody did. I'm sure many people did. But I'm sure it was a common thing.
Hemingway was the first one to name it. And write
he
a book.
He named it. He put it in a book. Yeah. A lot of early cocktail history is literally just who wrote it down first and who wrote it down somewhere where lots of people could read first.
Ah.
Just true. So moving on, another spirit Hemingway loved was gin. Even though he loved his vermouth, which we covered, he liked his martinis just bone dry. And he really had a romanticized view on martinis. He has a great quote that is, "I've never tasted anything so cool and clean. They made me feel civilized."
Oh.
Yes.
Is that what a martini does to you? Do you feel civilized?
I feel like I ought to be civilized when I drink a proper martini. I don't know if I always do. It feels like two very opposite inclinations, because martinis make me want to be uncivilized. But
maybe the first one I feel civilized. Yes. The second and third one. Just kidding. That's a lot. Or maybe, I don't know. Over the course of a day, perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think this is a good moment to talk about the cold faction in Hemingway's drinks, because he liked his drinks with not olives, but cocktail onions. And Ooh. He liked to freeze his martini onions ahead of time. He would also freeze his glass, and he would also freeze his ice in cut down tennis ball tubes to make long tubes of ice to keep his drinks cold.
Yeah, you could make a whole pitcher and put it in there.
Drinks being cold was a big thing of his. There's even like one of his skipper was quoted as saying that once you've held a drink in your hand for 30 minutes, you should discard it.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. So you drink it or you just get rid of it because it's not cold anymore.
Oh, man. I don't know if I agree with that point. I don't think I'd do that.
I actually, if we're talking about a drink that has ice in the glass,
Okay.
Because ice dilutes. I don't know. I could believe that. One drink that came up that I had never heard about before, and I am excited because I feel like over on the video component, this is the one that I really want to remake, is something called a Green Isaac Special. Ooh. And this was one that Hemingway wrote about. It was mentioned in the book that was published after his death, Island in the Stream. And his character drinks a drink that's made of gin, lime juice, coconut water, and chipped ice with enough Angostura bitters to give it a rusty rose color.
Ooh.
I really want to play around with that idea, that mixture, because it seems like something that sounds really tasty.
Yeah, definitely.
So you've got rum, you've got gin, you've got champagne, you've got vermouth. Hemingway had a very, nuanced and admirable drinking palate. But how palatable was the man?
Hold on. Right before, did you know why it was called Papa Double?
Because it was a double?
Yeah, but also Ernest Hemingway's nickname was Papa. He came up with him himself at the age of 27 and made all of his friends in Paris call him Papa.
Yeah, that's what he's referred to as Papa in a lot of this stuff. Oh, okay. I didn't know he created that himself.
Yeah, he nicknamed himself Papa.
That's cute.
Which perhaps brings us to our next discussion of, as you said.
So Hemingway, obviously a creator and imbiber of many highly palatable drinks, but we do want to talk about a little bit about how palatable was the man, because he's a controversial figure. I think that there are equal portions of society that hold him up as a hero and also condemn him as trash. So I think it's an important discussion to have, and maybe realize that most people fall somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, let me start this with a little bit of a confession for myself. So I actually never read anything by Hemingway because Julia Stiles told me it was a waste of time in the classic 90s movie, 10 Things I Hate About You. If y'all aren't familiar, there's this whole speech in her English class where one of the other students comments that Hemingway is romantic, and her response is, "Romantic? Hemingway? He was an abusive, alcoholic misogynist who squandered half his life hanging around Picasso trying to nail his leftovers." And to quote another 90s movie, way harsh. Yeah, that was way harsh, Kat. Way harsh, Julia Stiles.
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. Before we proceed, I do want to say this. You cannot talk about Ernest Hemingway without at some point having to confront the way he ended his life. And We're going to get into a little bit about that. He succumbed to suicide in the end. So we're going to talk about that now. Other stuff, but that's going to come up. So I want to give you all a warning. If you don't want to talk about that right now, you don't hear about that right now, that is totally fine. Mm-hmm. All of our drink-related information about Ernest Hemingway, we have put out there for you all. And we're going to get into a little bit of a more nuanced discussion about things that maybe contain a bummer. So we just wanted to give you a heads up. It's totally okay if you're not in the mood right now to listen to this. But I personally feel the need to discuss anybody that I think gets thrown too readily into the camp of you were a depressed alcoholic and you killed yourself. Like that's a lot of the dialogue around Hemingway. And it gets under my skin. So we're gonna talk a little bit about who the man was and maybe, you know, why he's problematic, but also why he is an important figure. So you are more than welcome to tune out right now if that's not something you want to hear about. And total respect, you are more than welcome.
Right. Well, I definitely started this with like a little bit of a had been influenced by Julia Stiles' character in my approach to Hemingway. But when I learned, the more I learned about his life, the more it actually okay, so you know the Dos Equis commercials with the most interesting man in the world, right?
Yes, yes.
The character is very much based on kind of like a combination of James Bond and Ernest Hemingway, which is really like when you think about that, it's really interesting because I actually reading about Hemingway was really reminded of the things that we talked about in the episode where we talked about the fictional character James Bond's alcoholism and like how it seems there's a really good argument and theorization that James Bond is suffering from severe PTSD because of the stress of his job and the things that he's seen and the things that he's gone through. And the kind of, I can't help but think these are both really deeply flawed and psychologically damaged characters, except for like Hemingway is a real guy. So the first thing that came up for me in my research is his World War One experience. Like he was 18 and he volunteers he has poor eyesight, so he can't enlist in the army. So he volunteers to be part of the ambulance, the Red Cross ambulance drivers. And you know that they saw some shit. World War One was like huge in a big way of bombs being warfare had changed. People weren't just getting shot; people were being blown apart. And there was one thing that I read. There's no way that it couldn't have scarred him. He actually talks about it. He describes it in some of his writings through the eyes of a character. But it is something that he went through where they went to look for survivors after an explosion, and when they couldn't find whole survivors or whole people who had not survived, they started collecting parts. Like that right. is that's I mean just the impact of having seen that. Even today our country struggles with properly rehabilitating soldiers returning from war with psychological trauma. Back then, like 1919, like there's no way that fact was widely known or accepted.
Right. No, I mean, I think that's true. Like the disassociation, that one thing that we talk about that I remember learning early on when I studied Hemingway, and it was something that was, there's like a type of writer that loves Hemingway, and they're very much like just the facts, like just present the facts. And there's a type of writer that hates Hemingway that's like, oh, you want to strangle your emotions? You don't want emotions? And I feel like both kind of miss the point of Hemingway, which is there is a retelling that is the need to, I'm going to tell you what happened and I'm going to hope you have emotions about it. Because he is so straightforward. To me, it's like you see his trauma in his writing. His lack of emotions and his need to just tell what happened, even because so much of his writing is that, like, you're it's, mm-hmm. even when it's fiction, it's autobiographical.
Yeah,
all of his books come from his life. He is not a great imaginative force. All of his books come from his life. He is changing names and people, and maybe he's putting himself on the front lines as a soldier instead of as an ambulance driver, but he is writing about his life. And while he's not requesting sympathy, he's presenting facts that inspire sympathy. So I don't think he's an apathetic writer. I just think he's somewhere in between. And I don't know. I think that's very, you see his psychology in his writing right. very clearly.
I mean, you know that I'm obsessed with kind of like from my obsession with the minds of sociopaths and psychopaths. I'm not saying that Hemingway was a psychopath by any means. I'm just like, when you start to look at psychological trauma in that way, first I was like, okay, but that doesn't really, okay, but then that doesn't really excuse the misogyny. Like, he didn't write women characters that nicely. He was kind of mentally abusive to his spouses. There's one thing that really rubbed me the wrong way when I came across some of this was he had written a letter to his editor talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald and saying that a sick woman had ruined him. And of course, I mean, we're talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald, so we're talking about Zelda, which is like, this is the epitome of an example of gaslighting. Like, maybe she's crazy, but also her husband kind of made her crazy and took credit for all of her writing, and like, there's that. But then also I came across some really interesting information about like Hemingway's relationship with his mother and maybe even some psychological damage from that. First, I kind of was dismissive about it because I came across something that was like, oh, his mother made him dress up like a girl. And first I was like, okay, well, Victorian children, a lot of them were dressed in gowns, no matter if they were boys or girls. But it turns out, at least according to his older sister, Marceline, who wrote kind of a tell-all later, and this is what she claims, if this is true, I can really kind of see where the seeds of misogyny might have happened. By her account, their mother was really obsessed with the idea of twins. So she would dress Marceline and Ernest up in similar clothes and take them out and be like, oh, these are my twin daughters, and would call him Ernestine. Now, this is like her account. I'm not saying it's true or it's not true, because I feel like when it comes to like family members writing tell-all accounts, because he was very secretive about that part of his life. But it seems like regardless of whether or not that's true, there's some feelings that he had around that kind of colored his relationship with women in a way. A lot of the women that he was involved with were older women, so he might have had some issues he was trying to resolve with his mother. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. But he also like came from war with a little bit of emotional damage because he fell in love with a Red Cross nurse who was like 8 years older than him, and she decided she didn't want to be with him, and she wrote a letter to him that she was engaged to an Italian officer, and that apparently scarred him emotionally. And people theorize that was why in all of his marriages he would always leave the marriage before his spouse could leave him. It's not an excuse, but it's nuance.
He's one of those figures that there's a certain bar where I get like, okay, this person, by modern day standards, we would judge pretty harshly. But when you look at his life, when you look at what he went through, I mean, like I said, we're going to get to the sad stuff. What led to him choosing to end his life?
Mm-hmm.
The man was born with hemochromatosis, which is an incredibly painful and undiagnosed, never diagnosed. It causes a lot of degradation of organs. It causes depression. It causes a lot of pain. He had, after his injury in World War I, he had 2 plane crashes.
He had a lot of injuries.
A lot of injuries that led to this recognition that he probably had. He had massive brain trauma. I mean, we all, like, this is, it's actually, it's funny because it's not outdated. It's something we talk about now, where, like, football players that have the amount of brain injury that, like, cause them to be depressed and, like, have suicidal ideations. Like, this is what we're talking about. This is, you know, an early example of this case that we have documented. Like, Hemingway, when you look at his life, he was an adventurer. He lived life. But because of the damage he had accrued, he had very physical levels of pain that were hard to live with. Part of his drinking came in from, he was self-medicating against the pain and depression that his life had given him. It's hard to really put somebody in a box like that, where, you know, he was writing. And really, one of the main reasons that people attribute to where he was at when he succumbed to his pain was that he couldn't write anymore. So somebody that had lived through so much and had documented it all, had written it all, but found himself in a place where he couldn't document anymore. I think it's
amazing that like he had lived through what he was living through and had that brain condition all of his life and not been diagnosed, and then to have so much literal, like he cracked his skull in one of his plane crashes. He had brain damage, but he was still writing. Like the fact that he kept writing as long as he did is amazing.
Well, and like you said, like even I don't want to discredit the psychological pain that he was dealing with. Like he had trauma in a time that we didn't know how to talk about trauma. Mm-hmm. I do think honestly, and this is just me, this is not a proven thing, but we talk about Hemingway's writing so often that you talk about it in like this non-emotional scientific way. But to me, as a very scientific-minded person who has had my nominal trauma, but the way that I think sometimes certain brains justify trauma is to delineate it in very clean, clear fashion. Like, then we can understand it if it's cleanly laid out in front of us. I think that his writing style makes sense with what he went through. He writes about things very devoid of emotion because then you can see the facts for what they are, mm-hmm. right? I don't like the simplification of Hemingway into a misogynistic, alcoholic, depressed mess, because I think that you can't read his writing he wasn't great about writing about women. And I'm saying that as, you know, someone that was, assigned female at birth. Like, that bothered me. But there is a human beneath that writing that is very much an exemplification of our inability to treat and recognize the suffering that our American soldiers go through.
Right. His very close friend and mentor and godmother of at least one of his children, Gertrude Stein, was one of the major figures at the time who called him and like said, all of you expats, you are the lost generation. That's just it. And she actually encouraged, because he got some of his writing style from writing as a reporter and writing so concisely, this sentence doesn't need to be more than four words. And she really encouraged that too in him. You know, she was, as far as forward thinkers and writers and artists at the time, I think that she probably saw that in him, that that is the way that people are going to be able to get that out of your work. Less is more, because if you just paint a picture, like tell them what you're seeing, you don't need to tell them what to feel, because it's right there. If they understand what you're saying, then they're gonna get it. I don't know. It's complicated. It's fucking complicated, man.
Well, it's okay that it's complicated. It's okay if you have read Ernest Hemingway's books and thought, you know what, I don't like the way he portrays women. I think that's one of the biggest complaints. And his actual interaction with women in his life. The thing about Hemingway that gets under my skin the most is that when you look at the years that he lived in, the decades that he lived in, they were some of the hardest years in American history. And he was mainly on the front lines of those. So he was just a human. Like, let's leave out anything else about him. He was a human that was processing this. And in most of that, he was getting by. You know, he was drinking more than he should. He wasn't aware of other people as much as he should have been. But he still managed to produce epic quantities of work for us to understand where he was at.
Yeah, I think that really gets at the heart of it. Because I think that a lot of the rhetoric that modern writers and modern thinkers and modern readers who take umbrage with the way that he writes, this kind of like machismo thing going on, is really reactionary to the opposite thing, which was people kind of glamorizing and romanticizing him in a way that's like, neither of those are correct. Mm-hmm. He's not a monster, and also he's not a fucking hero. Like,
no,
he's just
absolutely not.
He's just a dude. Like, he's just a human. It's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you can say this about a lot of figures throughout history, like him being a postmodern American writer and like kind of defining the style in America. A lot of times we like to create heroes like that, and we kind of do people a disservice by, even today, like modern heroes, we do people a huge disservice by giving them this kind of godlike, I mean, nobody's saying that Hemingway was a god, maybe a literary god. We put them on this pedestal and like nobody can live up to that. No, nobody can live up to that.
Exactly. No, I think the best way to appreciate Hemingway is as a human, is as somebody that was living through an extraordinarily terrifying period of time in history, in world history. And he's somebody that wrote about it very cleanly. And the thing that I love the most about Hemingway, the thing that because I remember when it was, I felt like it wasn't cool to like Hemingway. Mm. I went through a period of time like that. I don't know. I went to art school and I felt really weird about the fact that I loved Hemingway and Vonnegut. And those are very different authors, but the thing they have in common is that they're very just like, these are the facts and this is what they are. And that's the kind of writing I love. So it made sense. That was what I related to. But so few of us are flawless, but I think everybody has something to offer, to learn from.
Yeah.
And in the case of Hemingway, at his core, there is that awareness of this is where I am and this is what I can enjoy right now. And so I will enjoy it. That I think that's what I loved about Hemingway the most. And that's what I still love. Because he did go through scary times and he did go through times of lack. And I think that's the thing. Why did I, as a child, idealize every fanciful food passage in every book? It's because, I don't know, we didn't go without as kids, but we definitely didn't. We were not haves. We didn't have the exposure to lots of things, and that ability to just to embrace what the world has to offer that Hemingway so does. Like, he wants you to know about the bubble structure of French champagne. He wants you to know about the sweet bitterness of Campari. He wants you to know about things that you should know about.
And the man's got good taste.
He does. And I think that that's he's a harbinger of, like, I can't guarantee that the world will still be here tomorrow, but if you only have one day, I'm going to tell you how best to spend it. And right now, that kind of feels right. So that's kind of the core of The Lost Generation, though, right? We don't know what's happening, but we're going to keep creating and keep making and keep pushing forward.
Yeah.
Wait, is our avocado toast just the modern incarnation of The Lost Generation?
Oh, I hope not. I think we have better things to offer than avocado toast. All right. But avocado toast is pretty good.
Should we come around and say some final thoughts on Ernest Hemingway?
On Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah. Oh, another reason why he wanted the nickname Papa was because he didn't like his name, Ernest. That was supposedly, allegedly. That's a pretty misplaced piece of trivia. I should have said that earlier, but
that's interesting.
Oh, Papa.
You know, when you look at his life, he accomplished a lot, he wrote a lot, he dealt with a lot of pain. And at the end of the day, he succumbed to an immense amount of both physical and mental pain. Mm-hmm. That was not something that we even recognized at that time period or could treat at that time period. When I look at Hemingway's life, and I think one of the reasons that I was so fascinated by him as a young person was because he traveled, because he saw the world, because he went different places and he experienced gutturally the different things, the taste, the food, the people. He has that great quote, like you said earlier, like the best way to know people is just go to their bars. That is a quote that Hemingway said, and Anthony Bourdain, one of my other idols, has repeated, you know. And I think that's something that it's sad that both the figures I just mentioned succumbed to suicide at the end of their life, but it's something that I hold up as a tenet of something that I think they got just super fucking right, and that's that the world is worth exploring. I hope when I die I have a whole palette of drinks that people subscribe to me, of dishes. People say, you know what Taylor loved? They love this drink at this bar. Like, I think that the thing that I admire most about someone like Hemingway is that he lived his life and he made a mark, and he made something that people show up in droves to experience. So, I don't know. The world is, it's shut off from us right now, and that makes us a lot sadder, but I think that as controversial as a figure he is, like, when the world opens up again, make your myth and make it a fucking good one.
I feel like we can, I feel like that is, there. We're not going to have a better ending than that. That was beautiful. Well, right. I have one more gulp in my drink. Let's drink to Hemingway. Right. Do you
I will put a little rum in my glass.
Okay. All right. To Papa.
To Papa.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks for sticking with us with our new schedule. I know it's a little bit unpredictable right now, but thank you for sticking with us and bearing with us. We are going to be on live again this weekend, so tune in Friday and Saturday. We'll have a chance for us all to hang out and have a little cocktail hour. Thank you to Absurdist for our theme music. Thank you to all of our Patreon members, all of our new members, and people who have upped your donations. You're amazing. Thank you so much. We literally could not be doing this without you. And thank you to everybody who's supported us, everybody who's shouting us out on Twitter. If you want to find us, we are at NeatBoozedCast on Twitter and Instagram. And we are going to put our Patreon in the show notes. So thank you so much, everybody.
All right. Well, I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.
Thank you all. Have a great night. Thank you so much.
Thank you.